Hello and welcome to Rules-Based Audio, a Lowy Institute podcast. In this series, we're exploring the rules-based order, a concept that is ever more prominent in debates about how the world works and how it should work. I'm Sasha Fegan, and I'm a research associate at the Australia Security and the Rules-Based Order program here at the Lowy Institute. And I'm delighted to welcome Major General Mick Ryan to the podcast today. Mick's been a member of Australia's Defence Force for over 35 years. Over his long career, he's held a range of roles from operations to command, planning and strategic reviews of the Defence Force, as well as writing the Army's contributions to the Defence White Paper and Force Structure Review. More recently, he was the commander of the Australian Defence College. Mick's an avid tweeter, a science fiction aficionado, and I think you could say he's been a kind of unofficial thinker in residence for Australia's Defence Force. Mick's just launched his first ever book in Washington. It has a very timely title, War Transformed, The Future of 21st Century Great Power Competition and Conflict. Mick Ryan, a very warm welcome to you.
Thanks, Sasha.
Mick, it seems the ideas in your book are being played out on our screens right now. I know you've been watching events in Ukraine unfold very closely, so let's start there if we may. Russia's primary military objective at this stage appears to be taking Kiev. Thinking back just a few years, back to the Battle of Mosul in Iraq, that lasted a very bloody 9 months. Is this the level of conflict you expect to see in Kiev? Are we up for protracted urban warfare?
I think that is a distinct possibility, although predictions with warfare are always very difficult because this is a two-sided endeavour and humans are very clever and like surprising each other. But Kiev isn't the political objective for the Russian president, right? It's an enabler to what his objective is, which is to have a country in proximity to Russia that's more aligned with his ways of thinking and provides, at least to the Russian way of thinking, a security buffer against encroachment by NATO and the Western Europeans. So I think some kind of siege of Kiev is a possibility, but the amount of military resources that will be required, if that is what the Russians are trying to do, will be extraordinary. It will probably be the vast majority of Russian forces that are deployed. And notwithstanding the tactical challenges politically, this is going to make things even more difficult for the Russians.
Mick, you talk in the book about how time and duration of conflicts is a challenge for Western governments. In a nutshell, we like short and decisive wars. Do you think part of Putin's strategy here includes fighting for a long time? Is time on his side?
Yeah, I think, you know, Western nations are good at 24-hour news cycles and 3 to 4 year election cycles. What we're bad at is the microseconds and decades of 21st century warfare. I actually think time is not on Putin's side here. I think the longer this goes on, the more difficult it is for him politically from an external perspective, but also domestically. You know, I think you are starting to see the initial indications of Russian citizens being very discomforted by what they're seeing against a neighbouring country with their children, who, frankly, don't seem to have their heart in this invasion.
Putin decided to put Russia's nuclear forces on high alert recently. As Russia does become more isolated from the international system, its economy will nosedive. That international, domestic resistance that you spoke about will probably increase. Desperate times lead to desperate measures. How seriously do you take that nuclear escalation, the threat of nuclear escalation?
We should never discount what the Russians say, but they have a track record of referring to nuclear capabilities, not so much threatening to use them, but referring to them as part of a lot of their military operations. So we need to not overreact at what Putin has said here. But, you know, my sense is it might be one measure of the concern that he feels about the lack of progress in Ukraine, just as the offer of negotiations might be another measure of the concern the senior Russian leadership and Putin himself might be feeling about lack of progress.
And in terms of that offer of negotiations, do you think that's a stalling tactic to buy time, to resupply?
I don't see it really as anything else. I mean, the Russians are in a inferior negotiating position now than what they were a week ago, because the Ukrainians have called their bluff and done it very effectively so far. The Russians have nothing to offer the Ukrainians in negotiations because they haven't been able to seize things from them through force of arms. My sense is, just as we saw in the lead up to this campaign with Russian diplomacy, these negotiations will be used to buy time to probably fix how they're conducting operations on the ground, move in additional forces from their second echelons, deploy additional land, air, missile and air defence forces from garrisons that are further away, and potentially even step up industrial production of precision missiles and other consumables that they will have used a lot of in the last week.
Just getting back to that nuclear issue, though, just very hypothetically, to put the nuclear weapons on high alert, to start talking in those escalatory terms, do you think he even has a target in mind? What could you possibly hit with nuclear weapons, and what strategic gain would there be for him?
Now, Russian military doctrine does talk about this openly, about the use of nuclear weapons for tactical targets and campaign and theatre targets. I tweeted a really good Rand Pracy on this morning. So the Russians do see a use for lower yield nuclear weapons as part of campaigns potentially like this one, but in regional conflict. So they use those kind of words. Now, a lot of that is posturing, of course, because once you use one nuclear weapon, it can escalate pretty quickly, potentially. And I don't think even the Russians are keen to use them or have them used against them.
What's a lower yield target in non-military terms? Is that a military base? Is that a small town? What is that?
I think a lower yield target might well be something such as a major airbase that's being used to bring in supplies from outside. It might be a major logistics facility that is the major place where precision munitions are stored. It might just be a very difficult tactical enemy unit that they just haven't been able to get around. So there's a range of things you might imagine. But I still think it's very, very low probability.
One of the issues that you deal with in your book is how nations define success in 21st century warfare. And you talked a bit earlier about Putin's objectives for Ukraine. But has this invasion changed your view? Or what else does it tell you about how Russia defines success? What does a win look like for Putin in Ukraine?
It's hard to imagine what a theory of success looks like for Putin now. And I think even a week ago, it was difficult to see what it is. I mean, the only way the Russians can really win now is through more firepower, which means more bloodshed. And you can't win that way, frankly, at the strategic and political levels. So the theory of victory for Putin now is probably the greatest guessing game in most Western capitals, to be quite frank. And there are vastly smarter people than I who are engaged in that, and they should be and are. But, you know, for him, I think there's not much now that he can call a success with this campaign, domestically or internationally.
What would he hope to walk away with, though, at this stage?
Well, he could potentially hope to walk away with a puppet regime installed in Kiev or somewhere else. He might be able to walk away with additional ground that's been seized, but potentially more land around Donbass, that area, or a land bridge that goes all the way through from Russia to the Crimea. They might call that a success. They've largely achieved those objectives. But the reality is it means Ukraine would remain unfinished business for Russia. The war is not over if that is what they claim as a successful outcome. I don't see a long-term stable political outcome here other than Ukraine as a sovereign democratic nation and Russia not invading its neighbours.
Well, moving on to technology, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about the pace of technological change and talking about how we're currently in a period of accelerated technological change. And I really liked the quote you had from Elizabeth Garvey, who talked about how the current era repeats themes of previous industrial revolutions, which is the convergence of new and evolved technologies, which together change the scale, scope, and complexity of our collective intellectual landscape. So, and you argue that militaries and governments need to master that change in order to win wars. I think a lot of people, a lot of commentators prior to this thought that Russia was at the forefront of kind of mastering or blending, taking advantage of that technological change and having a kind of new intellectual perspective to it. What do you think?
I think the Russians have always had a certain level of competency in introducing new technologies, but the Russians have never had the same fascination with advanced technologies as, say, the Americans have had. The Russians have had a fascination with new ideas about military operations all the way through since the 1930s. And we've seen more recently with their military strategy from 2021, the work of Gerasimov and other Russian military theorists over the last 5-6 years with things like active defense, a new generation warfare. They have been very active in coming up with new ideas about the use of military and other national security elements to achieve political outcomes. It is not clear to me that those ideas have been proven so far. They remain hypotheses put forward by the Russian military that are yet to be proven. They've certainly been tested. They've been sorely tested by the Ukrainians. And at this point, it remains an open question whether that theoretical investigation by the Russians will work out for them over the course of this campaign.
You're talking about information warfare, the idea of kind of manipulating the perceptions of adversaries, manoeuvring decision-making processes, and even the kind of thing that we saw in the 2016 election. And there's so much literature in the West on this topic. Do you think we've overestimated the threat of Russia's capabilities in this area?
Potentially. I will caveat that by saying in every war, there's so many things that happen that you just don't see. There's no such thing as full transparency in these kind of things, sometimes not even partial transparency. So there'll be a lot of tactical actions that are playing out as we speak between Ukrainians and Russians that will go unrecorded for hours, days, weeks, and might just be in the histories down the track. There may well be a lot more autonomous systems and counter-drone systems, electronic warfare and other new technologies being used. But from what we are seeing, it's clear the Russians are not being very imaginative in the use of new technologies. They are not being very imaginative in the integration of all ground force combat elements, such as engineers, infantry, tanks, artillery, electronic warfare. And they haven't been terribly imaginative in air-land integration. I mean, those airborne operations were a catastrophe. All you got to do is watch A Bridge Too Far to know how difficult these things are, and you don't drop paratroops where the enemy has mechanized forces. They seem to have made some pretty fundamental errors here.
They seem also to be losing the social media war as well, which nobody expected, because the Ukrainians have definitely been very vocal on social media in terms of dominating the narrative space over this conflict.
They have been masterful. The Ukrainians, from the president down, have leveraged social media in a global influence campaign that is well and truly working in their favour. I mean, the president, with his tweets and short videos that he puts out regularly, has just been amazing. There has been a massive underestimation of the capabilities of this Ukrainian president and his capacity to unify his people, but also make transparent to the world what is going on. I mean, he has inspired his people. He's been an exemplar. I mean, that quote from recent where he said, "The fight is here. I don't need a ride. I need ammunition." I mean, wow, that's great stuff from a leader.
It's like something out of a Western or a Hollywood movie.
Well, yeah, but people respond to that, you know. And I think the heart of the matter is Ukrainians have purpose. They're defending their homeland. They've seen what democracy and personal liberties is like. And they are saying to the world, this is worth fighting for. And for me, it's not just worth fighting for in Ukraine. It's worth fighting for everywhere. So they have purpose, and it's not clear to me that these young Russian soldiers who have gone into Ukraine as part of an invading Russian force share the same kind of purpose.
I think it's fair to say that Australia's interest in this conflict goes beyond the terrible refugee and humanitarian crisis, beyond the violation of the rules-based order. It goes to whether China will see this as a template for a potential invasion of Taiwan. What will Chinese military planners be looking at most closely in this conflict?
I think it's an important point. I mean, the Americans looked at an invasion of Taiwan during the Second World War, and the Chinese Communist Party in the late 40s also looked at an invasion of Taiwan, and they both came to the conclusion it's really, really hard and we'll need hundreds of thousands of people. But if I'm an old man who's a authoritarian leader sitting in Beijing at the moment, what might I take from this? I think the first thing is how the Americans have been able to build an effective coalition to build a regime of sanctions that will continue to bite on the Russians, including suspending most recently of SWIFT, but a whole range of other things, including closing airspace to the Russians and generally making the Russians a state that people don't want to have anything to do with. They will also look at how countries and their leaders, such as the United States, France, Germany and the UK, have been making decisions, have been collaborating, how quickly they can do that, and how well they can make those decisions about political and military strategic areas. They'll also look, I think, finally, just how the Russian military have performed here. You know, going into the country without achieving air superiority, the use of long-range missiles early, but probably not in sufficient quantities, the apparent paucity of electronic warfare and information operations and counter-drone capabilities deployed by the Russians. I mean, they'll be looking at all these things and they'll be learning and they'll be reconsidering the calculus of whether taking Taiwan by force is a viable option or not.
And presumably also just the resistance of an unarmed population who have come out so strongly, even with Molotov cocktails, without weapons in large part, but have been able to repel Russian control.
Yeah, I think this is one of the great lessons that, you know, every generation of Ukrainians has stepped up to the challenge here. There's a sense in some commentators that millennials or Gen this or Gen that is, you know, somehow not up to the challenges of the 21st century, or they're called other things. But I think this is proven that's just not true. It certainly hasn't been my experience in the Australian Army. Each successive generation is actually better, smarter, tougher, and more collegiate when they work together. We're seeing that play out in the Ukraine now. They are stepping up at every level of their society, in the military and in their broader civilian society, to say, we're not going to stand for this. Democracy is worth defending, and we're going to place our own lives on the line to ensure that our country sustains and improves the prosperity and the democracy that it deserves.
Getting on to Australia now, because I don't know about you, but I'm a little surprised at how much Scott Morrison has involved Australia in this conflict. Australia's participating in the sanctions regime against Russia. We're fast-tracking applications from displaced Ukrainian citizens. We're sending what the Prime Minister has rather euphemistically described as lethal aid via NATO partners. But what about other government agencies? I'm just thinking about agencies like the Australian Signals Directorate. Back in 2019, Mike Burgess, who's now the head of ASIO, who was then the head of the Australian Signals Directorate, gave a speech here at the Lowy Institute, which revealed for the first time the type of operations ASD conducts. And he talked about some examples from the Middle East in 2016, when ASD disrupted an operation by disconnecting ISIS commanders from the internet, destroying propaganda material, turning off servers. Is this the kind of thing that you could reasonably expect ASD to be doing now or in the near future with Russia?
So I'll go back to your original proposition about you're a little surprised about Australia's approach. I was entirely unsurprised. Australia has been a nation since its very founding that's always stood up for the values we believe in. We sent 300,000 soldiers to World War I to do that. You know, we sent hundreds of thousands away in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan to do that. So we should not be surprised that an Australian government commits to supporting the defence of a democratic country, regardless of where it is anywhere on the globe. Our nation is reliant on a functioning international system that's built on fair play, democracy, fair trade, and a range of other values that we hold dear as Australians. The involvement of Australian agencies, I am absolutely certain they have a role to play, that they are watching closely, that they are talking to their colleagues around the world about where we can provide support. But I think the Australian participation in sanctions, the Prime Minister has also announced both lethal and non-lethal aid and the potential for humanitarian intake from Ukraine should that become necessary. These are all very suitable and the kind of things that I think that every democratic country would be considering at the moment.
And on ASD, what their involvement might be?
I would suggest most security agencies, whether it's Home Affairs, AFP, ASD, all the A acronyms, will be watching with interest. I won't speculate on the details of actual operations, but I have no doubt that all these agencies will be watching and learning as much as they possibly can.
Well, staying with Australia for now, getting back to this issue of adapting to technological acceleration, you've obviously had 3 decades in the Australian military. Part of your reason for writing the book is that you haven't always seen military leaders learn from past and current wars. So is the Australian Defence Force right now prepared on an intellectual level to meet the challenges of 21st century warfare?
I think it's fair to say that every Western military institution is always a little deficient in this regard. I mean, we're part of that tradition because we get absorbed by the issues of the day. That's what happens in Western democracies and their military institutions. We are masters of being surprised by the next war. That's just part of being a democracy because we are not inherently hostile against other countries. So we do get surprised. The real key for us is how quickly can we learn, adapt, improve, and succeed. I think we have come a long way over the last few years. I mean, I was involved in running, designing major army and joint exercises over the last decade. I've seen significant steps forward in the integration of Army, Navy, Air Force operations and their integration with the other arms of our national security agencies. Are we perfect at it? Well, probably not, mainly because there's no such thing as perfection in the profession of arms, but also because there's always an adversary trying to find weaknesses, to find those chinks in our armour that they can exploit. And indeed, as I find in the book, you know, the PLA has this notion, this concept of systemic destruction warfare. They will be looking for the seams in our organisations to exploit. The whole challenge for the ADF and the other arms of national security is about ensuring those seams either are not apparent or are joined up as closely as they can be. And I think, you know, largely we do a pretty good job at doing that, but our job also is about constantly honing and improving that.
But what about on an intellectual level? Are we open-minded enough? Is the imagination there?
You know, military organisations are often accused of not being very imaginative. My experience would be the most imagination occurs where the biggest problems are. You know, the adapt or die is an old saying, but it's pretty apt. Our tactical forces are very adaptive because every day they are out there training or on operations and doing the tough things that soldiers, sailors, airmen and women or aviators do, and they need to find solutions. The problem becomes in the middle and higher levels where the problems generally involve committees and stuff like this, and it's sometimes hard to make audacious decisions when you've got 20 or 30 people around the table who all have equities, or at least think they have equities, in some of the strategic challenges we face.
Are you confident that Australia has the technology it needs now or the pathways to getting the technology it needs now? I'm thinking about things like AI, even robotics, 3D printing, hypersonic weapons. Are we on the right path there?
I think, you know, technology has become largely a level playing field. The issue is what are our strategic priorities when it comes to the integration of some of these technologies. What is the right balance of some very expensive, exquisite, crude system versus cheaper, swarmed, autonomous systems in all the domains? And for me, long-range strike would be an area that is probably ripe for investment in long-range, uncrewed systems, you know, missiles, these kind of things. But also the teaming of humans with autonomous systems in the land, sea, and air domains. Historically, in military institutions, we have trained people to use tools. That includes flying planes, driving tanks, or driving ships. We use tools. Some of these autonomous systems and algorithms now permit us to truly team with each other. None of our training or education systems or military concepts are built on true teaming between humans and machines. That's an area where we really will need to think hard about and invest in the coming years.
You also talk about the challenge of climate change in the book. So just finally, what do you think Australia is prepared for that? Is the ADF prepared for that?
I don't think any country is really prepared for what might occur if there are very sudden shifts in weather and climate. I mean, the Tongan volcano is a great example. There's a lot of unforeseen things that might occur over the coming years. And the reason I cover it as a strategic driver is because it will challenge military organisations to train and prepare for the high end of conflict in the 21st century, as well as be prepared to support their nations to recover from potential climate catastrophes as well. Additionally, countries are going to probably have to spend more on mitigation, greening, and these kind of things that will compete for defence budgets in the 21st century. So it's a really important topic globally. It's an important topic for us to understand societally, and it's an important topic for military leaders to understand.
Unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there, Mick. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a very enlightening chat.
Thank you, Sasha. It was great to talk to you.
And just a reminder to listeners, Mick Ryan's book is called War Transformed: The Future of 21st Century Great Power, Conflict and Competition. That's all for this episode of Rules-Based Audio. Goodbye for now.